Okay, we're beginning here on the bottom of Kaf Chet Amud Bet by Rabbi Yehuda Omer by the two dots. Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah says that if you have a relative who passes away, that does not necessarily sever the relationship that you have. Rabbi Yehuda in the Mishnah says that if the daughter passes away, but there are grandchildren from that daughter and son-in-law, then the relationship with the son-in-law is still intact. So that leaves it intact despite the fact that the individual passed away. And then he has the distinction of Ohev and Sone, which the Gemara will get to in a second. Now the Gemara on this says, Amar Rav Tanchum, Amar Rav Tavla, Amar Rav Brona, Amar Rav, Halocha, K'Rav Yehuda. Halocha is like Rav Yehuda over here. Rav Amar Rav Nachman, Ein Halocha K'Rav Yehuda. Halocha is not like Rav Yehuda. V'chein Amar Rav Barachanam, Rav Yochanan, Ein Halocha K'Rav Yehuda. So here you have different memorot from the Amoraim as to whether the Halocha does follow Rabbi Yehuda's position or does not follow Rabbi Yehuda's position over here. Ika de matni lo lahad de Rabba Bar Chana aha. Some bring this memra of Rabba Bar Chana on this. Etzu darash Rabbi Yossi Aglili. This is a drasha that we have from Yossi Aglili. Ubat el kohanim el levi'im ve'le shofet asher yeh bayam imahem. You'll come up to the kohanim, the levi'im, and the shofet, the judges, asher yeh bayam imahem, that will be in that day. And the question, it's a famous question, the Gemara asks it here and other places, how is it possible for a person to go a shofet that's not in his time? So obviously, the person goes to the shofet that exists in his time. So what's the reason that the Pasuk says that you should go to the shofet asher yeh bayam imahem? Why would you need that type of qualifier when it's obvious and apparent that that's what you would have to do? So in other places, the other drashot on this pasuk are that kiyiftach bedoro, kishmuel bedoro, and that just like Shmuel, who was a shofet par excellence, and yiftach was questionable type of shofet, but he's the shofet that you have in your time, and you can't go to Shmuel, so you have to go to yiftach, that wherever is the shofet b'yamimahim, that's the person you have to go to. That's the person you have to get the answers from or the adjudication from. But over here, Rabbi Yossi Aglili gives a different answer to that question. El ze sheya karov v'nit rachek. The situation in which the person was close, and then v'nit rachek, and afterwards they were distanced, meaning that there was a death that caused the severing of their relationship. And that's what it means, asher yeh v'yamimahem. He's the shofet now, because beforehand he was your relative, so he couldn't be your shofet. He had to recuse himself beforehand. At this point where he's not your relative, then he's the shofet by Yamim Mahim. So Amar Rabba Bar Chana Rabbi Yochanan Alocha to Rabbi Yossi Aglili. So this is interesting. The Gemara says that Rabba Bar Chana's statement was made over here and not over there. Now Rabba Bar Chana Amar Rabbi Yochanan's statement before was Ein Alocha to Rabbi Yehuda. Over here, the statement is that the Alocha is to Rabbi Yossi Aglili. So it's not a similar statement. It's not saying, oh, they said the Alocha to Rabbi Yehuda and somewhere else. But it's actually a different psak halacha. So whereas before, Rabbi Bar Chana Rabbi Yochanan said, Ein halacha k'Rabbi Yehuda, and you would think when the Gemara says, oh, they said it somewhere else, it means that they said Ein halacha k'Rabbi Yehuda in a different situation. But what the Gemara is saying is that they came to the same conclusion by saying it in a different way, which is that here they're saying the halacha is k'Rabbi Yossi HaGalili, and in doing so, they're also saying or implying that the halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda. Because Rabbi Yossi Aglili entertains the possibility that you could have been a relative and then have that relationship be severed and no longer be a relative. For Rabbi Yehuda, that relationship would persist beyond the death of the relationship that created the kirva between you. So the children of the father-in-law of Mar Ukva, that makes them his brothers-in-law. Krovim v'nitrachu, who? They were relatives, and then they were distanced. Meaning, Mar Ukva was married to their sister, so they are his brothers-in-law, not min haTorah. Gisim, as we saw in the last two daf min haTorah, are where individuals are married to two sisters. And that's considered to be a gis min haTorah. Over here, these are considered to be ach, ishto, the other terminology that the Mishnah used. But I'm just using it in the way that colloquial, which is that these are his brothers-in-law because he married their sister. The sister passed away. His wife passed away. So now they were once relatives, and now they're no longer related because his wife has passed away. So the connection that drew them close through that marriage is now terminated. Atu lekameh ledina. So they came before him for adjudication. Amar lehu, he said to them, psilna lehu ledina. I have to recuse myself from the case. I am not qualified to judge the case for you. So Amrulei, they said to him, my datech, to Rabbi Yehuda? You paskan like Rabbi Yehuda says that the relationship survives the death of the party that connects you. Anan, Maitinan, Igarta Mimarova. We have brought a letter from Eretz Yisrael. Dein Aloha Rav Yehuda. The Aloha is not like Rav Yehuda. Amalahu, Atu, Bikava, Dekira, Idbekano, Bechu. He says, wait a minute, do you think that we are glued together with wax? Meaning that you think that our relationship or our being relatives is such a permanent type of glue or permanent situation that we're stuck together and that's why I'm recusing myself? Why I'm saying to you that I am recusing myself over here is because the problem is that you guys don't listen to me. You guys don't listen to my psak. So I'm not going to be the judge in the case because you're not going to follow through or you're not going to listen to what I'm saying. So his point was that he did not recuse himself because he was a relative. He recused himself because he didn't think that they were going to listen to what he said. But that means, in essence, he's saying that the halacha is not like Rabbi Yehuda. Because once his wife had passed away, he says, we're not glued together for life. The thing that brought us together was the marriage. Once the marriage is terminated, we're no longer relatives anymore. That relationship now has been severed or terminated, just like the marriage terminates at death. So too, the relationship terminates at death, and there's no longer a problem of relatives or individual being a relative testifying over here. Right now, the Gemara goes to the latter part of the Mishnah, which is that Rav Yehuda makes a distinction for two parties. One is an ohev, and one is a sone, that they are not allowed to testify. And then the Mishnah defines an ohev as shushbino, the best man, at his wedding. If you remember, we saw this in the Gemara of Bava Batra, we spent time on it, about the obligations of a shushbinin, and whether it's actually, there's a legal right for you to make a claim against the Shushbinin if someone's been your best man, that you can go back to them. But there's the idea that this is the closest individual to the Chatan. That's called an Ohev. So now, Ohev Zeu Shushbinov, Kama. What does that mean? Amar Rabbi Av, Amar Rabbi Yirmiya, Amar Rav, Kol Shivat Yimei Mishteh. All 7 days of Shavu Brachot. Rabbanan Mishmei Derov Amrei, Afilu Miyom Rishon Veilech. Even from the first day and onward. Now, there's a machloket here, clearly, between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim, as to how long this has implications, the Shushbinim. So the way that Rashi reads this is, that first statement is that the Shushbin has impact for all 7 days of Sheva Brachot, and he's considered to be biased during that period of time, according to Rabbi Yehuda. And the Rabbonon, Mishmei the Rav Amrei, Afilu Miyom Rishon Veilech, even from the first day on. So Rashi says over here, B'teila Shushbinut V'kashir L'Hayit. That the Shushbinut is wiped out, and he's kasher la'it. So from Rashi, it sounds like you have a qualification of two different positions over here, which is, the first statement is qualifying Rabbi Huda's position, which is that kol shiva yimei mishteh, that he's considered to be a Shushbin, and he's disqualified. Then we come back, v'rabbonu mishmei derover explaining the Chachamim's position, which is, afilu miyom rishon ve'elech, even from the first day already, he's not considered to be disqualified, so they don't even include the first day. Now, you could argue that afilu miyom rishon ve'elech means that after the first day, not the first day itself. But that is one way to explain this Gemara. The other way to explain this Gemara, and this is brought by the Yad Ramah, is to suggest that these qualifications are both of Rabbi Huda's position. And that is, how long do you have to be the Shushbin, or how long do you have to be around to qualify as a Shushbin? The first statement is, Amar Rabbi Av, Amar Birmiya, Amar Rav, Kol Shivat Yimei Mishteh. He's only classified as a Shushbin if he's there for all 7 days, for all 7 Sheva Brachot. And the Rabbanan say, even if he's there just for the first day, he's classified as a shushbin. So this might be defining what a shushbin is, according to Rabbi Yehuda, and therefore it has nothing to do with the position of the Chachamim. So it depends on how you read this Gemara as to which Tana they are qualifying, and then obviously that has implications about the position of the Rabbanon. The latter case where we spoke about the Yad Ramah, then the Rabbanon aren't mentioned here at all. And the Rabbanon basically say shushbin is irrelevant. According to Rashi's interpretation, that maybe that second statement is qualifying the Rabbanon's position. So again, there are different ways to read it, depending on who you think these are qualifying. A sone koshlo diber. A sone is someone who did not speak to the party over an issue for more than 3 days. Tan Rabbanan. So now the Gemara here quotes the psukim from Parshat Masay with regards to Ir Miklat. So in terms of the psukim themselves are speaking about the actual killer here, the person who's going to go to Galut. And it's trying to describe to us about the intent of the killer. Was this an unintentional murder, or was this an intentional murder? Was it manslaughter, or was it murder? That's what the psukim are discussing. What the Gemara is going to say here is that these psukim are actually discussing about the edim and the judges, about their intent or their relationship in this situation. So Tan Rabbanan, v'hu lo oyev lo. and he was not his enemy. Idenu, therefore he can be an aid. Velo mivakesh ra'ato, and he had no interest in bad things happening to him. Yedinenu, then he has a right to be a dayan. So now the Gemara here clearly is taking those out of context in terms of what the Pashtuta Pasuka is speaking about. Because if you go to Bamidbar Lamed Hey, in description of the person here, it's describing the person who accidentally killed this individual is now subject to galut. In bepeta b'vloi va hadafo, o yishlich alav kol kli b'lo tzdiya, o b'chol evan asher yamut ba b'lo re'ot, v'yapel alav v'yamot, v'hu lo oyev lo, v'lo mevakesh ra'ato. That's the statement here. Now the next pasuk, and we're going to see this in a second, is why the Gemara is pushed in this direction. It says, the next pasuk says, v'shafetu aida ben amakeu ben gol adam ha'mishpatim eile. You can already see the opening for them to say that it's speaking about Shoftim, at least the second part of the Pasuk, because the next Pasuk says, V'shafetu Aida. Now, as Rashi points out over here, that the reason behind this drasha that we have in the Pasuk is because we have plenty of psukim that speak about the issues of Galut, and Oyev, and Sonei. And therefore, these words, in a sense, are extraneous. And that's what Rashi brings over here, that the Iber Rotzeach, if you think you're speaking about the Rotzeach, which is the Pashtuta Pasuk, Haktiv in Dvarim Dalet, in Parshat Et Kanan, in the Parshia of Galut over there, it says, V'hu lo sone lo, that you already have. V'kray achrinei tuva. Plus you have Psukim in Parshat Mishpatim as well. Galut, or the issue of killing Mishugei, comes up a number of times in the Torah. And so Rashi says, the sone lo, V'hu so lo sone lo, we already know that information. So this is extraneous in the Pasuk of V'hu so lo sone lo. So that's why the Gemara dashes from Lusolene Lo that it's talking about an aid. And then Velo Mivakesh Rato, which is juxtaposed to the next pasuk, which is Shafetu Aida, that we connect to the Shoftim. So for that reason, Rabbi Yehuda dashes from this, the disqualification of Eidim and the judge that are either an Oyev, Sone, or the vice versa, the Ohev. So Ashkechan Sone. So from those psukim, you realize that a Sone cannot be an aid and cannot be a Dayan. Now, first of all, this is important here. The Machloket and the Mishnah between Rabbi Yehuda and the Chachamim is only about a Sonei for an aid. So Rabbi Yehuda says he's disqualified. The Chachamim says he's not disqualified. But as far as the Dayan is concerned, a Sonei is disqualified even according to the Chachamim. Now, Ohev Minalan. How do we know that an Ohev is also affected? Kari Behochi. Read the Pasuk in the following manner. Ve'u lo Ohev lo. Ve'lo Ohev lo. If he did not hate him and he did not love him, Ye'idenu. Then he can be an aid. V'lo mevakesh rato. He wasn't interested in detrimental things for him. V'lo tovato. And not good things happening to him. Yedinenu. Then he's a right to be a judge. So the Gemara now reads into the Pasuk an additional line or additional words that don't exist there, which is not only does he not hate him, but he doesn't love him. Meaning that they're saying that he is neutral towards this individual, and that's when he's allowed to be an aid, or he's neutral, and that's when he's allowed to be a dayan. The Gemara asks an obvious question, which is, where do you see the word ohev in that pasuk? It's one thing, even if you're taking them out of context, the words that you're reading, but at least those words are there. Now all of a sudden you're adding in words that speak of ohev. Elasvaru. The Gemara says it's just logical. Ohev, my time ma, what's the reason that an ohev may not testify? Mishom, demerchaka date. Because there's a distance, there's a chasm between the individual and the aid. And that causes there to be bias in the situation. Clearly by a judge that's the case, and that's why even the Chachamim agree there. But even by Edim, their perspective or the context in which they see things is going to be colored by the chasm that opens up between them. Ohev nami mikar vadate. So similarly, just in the reverse, someone who is close or loves the individual, he will be more apt to look at things in a positive light or to see things through that filter. And because of that, we're going to disqualify them. The same reason you would disqualify an Oyev, you would also disqualify an Ohev. Rabbanan, so what do the Rabbanan do with that Pasuk? Hai lo Yev lo, v'lo mevakesh rato, my darshi be. What do they do with those words? Chad a Dayan, one of them you're going to use for a Dayan, because they agree, as we said before, that by a Dayan he's disqualified. Idach, they're going to do, Kedetanya, Amar Rav Yosi Rav Yehuda, v'hu lo Yev lo, v'lo mevakesh rato. He darshins from that Pasuk, Mikan. If you have two Tamidei Chachamim who do not like each other, maybe even stronger language, they hate each other, they should not sit on the same Beit Din, or they should not sit in this adjudication together. And that is because their personal quarrel will spill over into their impartialness in the case. The person might take a position, nothing to do with the case, but because he has enmity towards the other judge, or he doesn't want to agree with the other judge. And that's going to color his view of the case, nothing to do with the case, but because of his relationship with that individual. Now, we don't want that type of bias entering into a court, whereby the individuals have personal vendettas or problems between them that's going to cause them to not adjudicate the case fairly and justly. Because the Chachamim agree with regards to a judge, not with an aide, but they use the pasuk to teach you not only about a judge, but about two judges, not anything to do with their relationship with the parties that are in front of them, but the relationship between the judges themselves, that also should disqualify the judges. And now the Mishnah moves on to discuss how we deal with the edim. At first, we're going to deal with it in a case of dinei mamonot, in a civil case, torts case. And then later on, the Gemara is going to come back and discuss it about dinei nefashot, in which we have some of the more famous lines that are found in the Mishnah that you'll be familiar with. So this Mishnah is dealing with dinei mamonot, which is ketzed bodkim et edim. How do you check out the edim to ensure that we know they're telling the truth and that they understand the ramifications of what they're doing here? So they bring him into a room, and then we instill fear and awe in them in order to intimidate the edim. We tell everybody else to leave. And then we leave the biggest of them, in the top aide here. How do you know so-and-so is obligated to pay so-and-so this money? If he says, you know what he said to me, Shani Chayav Lo, he said to me, he admitted that I'm Chayav to this individual, or he says, Ish Ploni Amarli Shu Chayav Lo, or he heard it from another person who told him that this guy owes the money, Lo Amar Klum. In both of these cases, he didn't say anything that's going to obligate. Now, the second statement, we understand why it's disqualified, is because he says, Ish Ploni Amarli Shu Chayav Lo, which is hearsay. That's Aid Mi Pi Aid. He heard it from another person. He didn't witness the event. And in the Torah, hearsay does not count, and so therefore that's why it's disqualified. Now, the first statement seems much harder, which is when he admits in front of him to the fact that he owes the money. Why over there is it not considered to be an obligation when he admits to owing the money? So the Gemara will discuss it, but I'll just say in a big picture, there are two reasons why you would say that. Either is because in the context in which he's saying it, he didn't intend for these people to be edim, or the other possibility is that the other party is not there. The toveya, the claimant, is not there. If the claimant is there, that might also impact on how we view the admission when he admits in front of a claimant. So we'll discuss that more in the Gemara, but that's why that statement is disqualified, even though it's an admission, which seemingly should be a good point of testimony. So obviously, if they heard in front of a edim where they were designated to be a edim and he admits, then of course he's going to be chayav. Or the most likely scenario is that they witnessed the loan being given. So that would be enough to make them witnesses in this state. Ad Shumar, until he says, Bifaneinu hodeh lo, shu chayav lo, matayim zuz. Until he says, before us, he admitted that he's chayav to this individual, matayim zuz. So that may be both pieces here. One is that he's admitting in front of us as a deem, and the other party is there. The toveya is there. Be'achar kach maknisim et hasheni. Then they bring in the next eight, ubodkim oto, and then they check him out in the same manner. Im nitzu divrehem kuvanim. If they find that the testimony of the two edim is parallel, then nosim and notim badavar, then they start to adjudicate, they start to discuss and deliberate the matter. Shnayim omrim zakai, v'chad omer chayav. Two of them exonerate. One says that he's obligated. Zakai. Then in that case, he is acquitted or exonerated. He does not need to pay. Two versus one, we go by the majority. Shnayim omrim chayav, v'chad omer zakai. Two say that he's obligated, one say that he is not obligated. Chayav, again, majority rules. Echad omer chayav, echad omer zakai. If one of them says chayav, and one of them says zakai, afilu shnayim mizakim or shnayim mechayvin. Or, even if two judges say that he is acquitted, or he doesn't have to pay, or two judges say that he is obligated to pay, vechad omer eini yodea, and one of them says, I don't know, yosifu adayanim. Then they have to add on judges. So the person who says eni yodea is as if he does not exist. And since he doesn't exist, now you have a short-handed beitin, because you only have two judges instead of the three judges that are required. For that reason, yosifu adayanim, we add on additional judges to the case. Gamru et davar, if they finally come to a conclusion with the new judges, they come to a majority with everybody voting in the situation, then they move on to the next stage. Now, what's interesting about this is it's a question in the Achronim as to whether a judge who believes that he's right, but he's in the minority, can he purposely scuttle the case? So you have a situation here, we have two judges that take one position, and you have a single judge who's in the opposing side. That single judge on the opposing side, if he votes with his position, where he knows this is what he thinks it is, he's going to lose the case, because he's in the minority. So he has an alternative, which is he could say, in Yodea, I don't know the outcome here, I don't know what the answer is, even though he's lying. If he does that, then they're going to have to bring in new Dayanim. And his hope is that when the new Dayanim come in, they're going to see the outcome, or they're going to see the case in a similar manner to that which he saw. So there's a machlok. When you do know the answer, are you allowed to intentionally say in Yodea in order to force the case to get more Dayanim? Or do you have to truthfully speak whatever it is, even though that you know that's going to cause you to lose the case, even though you think you are right or absolutely right in this case? So it's an interesting question that comes up about intent in towards of scuttling the case in order to bring in more judges so that it might go in your favor if you believe sincerely that you're so right that you don't want to give in to the other two judges. So gamnura ta davar, if they came to a conclusion, ayu machnisim otan, they bring the bali dinim back in, they bring the litigants back in. So that makes it clear that the judges stay there and they deliberate the case. And the litigants are not allowed to be there. Nobody's allowed to be there when the judges deliberate. Hagadol shebidayanim omer. So the head of the Beit Din gets up and says, Ish ploni ata zakai, ish ploni ata chayav. He gives the verdict, whether he is obligated or he's not obligated. Uminayin. Now we have a specific statement here about the protocol. How do we know the shekiyet say, when they leave the Beit Din, lo yomar ani mizakeh v'chaberai mechayvin. I wanted to acquit you in the case. My colleagues were the ones who said you are obligated. What can I do? They were the majority, and therefore I lost. On this it says, that you're not allowed to tail bear in your nation. And it also says, the one who goes around tail bearing and divulging secrets. So the two psukim over here, it's not clear which pasuk is brought. Many Mishnayot have both of them. You can see that Gota Gra tries to take one of them out. But it seems to me that there are two pieces of the puzzle here. There's, which is a demand that you do not speak Lashon Hara, that you do not implicate others or speak Lashon Hara. So that would be the case here, where he's implicating the other judges with a negative position against this litigant. So that he's not allowed to do. That's a problem of Lashon Hara. There's also Vomer, there's a secondary problem, which is that here, not only is this person speaking Lashon Hara, he's also divulging information that is not supposed to be in the public realm. And that is because two things. One is, when we have a Beit Din come to a conclusion, we want it to look as if it's a unanimous decision. Even though it may not be a unanimous decision, we want the Beit Din to act as a single entity and unit, and therefore give their psak so that it carries the weight of the whole Beit Din. That's the point. The point is that once the majority is determined what it is, we want that to be the decision of the Beit Din as a whole, not the decision of those that say in that manner. The only way you can do that is if you have the Beit Din put on a single face. This individual is disclosing information and saying that the Beit Din was divided over this. And again, even if truthfully they are divided over this, that's still not a reason to disclose it, because of the fact we want the face of the Beit Din to be unanimous. That's one reason. The second reason is that we don't want enmity being built between litigants and judges. And therefore, if you disclose the information, you're going to put biases or anger individuals at other parties, because the judges now are going to be on the hook for what they said vis-a-vis this party. And so we don't want that information being disclosed, because if it does that disclose, then it's going to hurt the relationship between the parties. All right, so now the Gemara says, Heicha amrinan lehu. What exactly would we say to the Edim to put the fear in them, to have them in awe, so that they understand that lying is not a good thing, or that lying is something that's going to bring terrible punishment, and that they have to think twice before they lie over here? So we give them this opportunity in private to admit that maybe they're lying, or maybe that they should not be edim over here. That's why we throw everybody else out, so they won't be embarrassed if they admit that they were lying. But we also don't want them taking comfort in other people being there. So we want them to be truthful, and we want them to understand and be intimidated, both in terms of the awe and fear and implications of what they're about to do. So that the Gemara brings, what do they say to them? Amar Rav Yehuda, Achi Amar Nanu, this is what you say to them. It's a pasuk that's quoted in the Gemara in Tanit with regards to rain. It says that the wind and the clouds gather, the geshem ayin, but then no rain comes. Ish mitalel b'matat sheker. That's the same thing as someone who makes a pledge and doesn't pay it. Just like a person makes a pledge and doesn't pay it, makes a lot of noise and hubaloo around his pledge and about all this goodness that he's doing. But in the end, he doesn't carry it through. He doesn't actually pay the money. He doesn't fulfill the obligations that he accepted. So too, is similar in nature is when you have all the signs of rain. You have all the clouds and the storminess and everything comes and the rain doesn't come. So that somebody puts on a front that projects a certain image, but underlying that, there's nothing. That's the same thing as a weather that comes that looks like it's going to give rain, it doesn't give rain. So over there, the psukim are just saying why the rain's not going to come is because people act like this. So now, the question is, what's the connection to our case over here? And it's likely the same thing about these edim. These edim are lying, so they are putting on a face, or they are blustery, like the storm. They're making something happen, which is really not true, or really shouldn't be there. So they're like these people who make pledges that aren't there, they're making statements that aren't untrue, and therefore they're indicating to them that the punishment is going to be severe, which is the withholding of rain. And that's a serious punishment, especially in Eretz Yisrael. And the Marashoa actually adds on and says that they're actually speculating that the people who hired them to come and testify falsely, they might be these type of people that are matat sheker. These are the type of people that make promises and never carry through on their promises. Yeah, they promise to pay you money, but in the end, they may not pay you the money. So you better think twice before you do this, because you may not get compensated for this evil that you're about to do. Amar Rova. Rova says about this, Yachli the Meimar, they deem in their minds can justify to themselves or have themselves escape from this punishment by saying, Shiv Shani Havakafno, there were 7 years of famine, but Baba Umna Lo Khalif, and the craftsman is never short of work. And the way Rashi describes it over here, it's a pitgam. It's some sort of saying or expression of the common folk, which is that there are times where people have means of parnasa outside of the problematic area. So yes, for a person who's a farmer or in an agrarian society, you can talk about the lack of rain impacting and scaring the individual. But these justify to themselves or talk themselves into doing this by saying, listen, yeah, there'll be a famine, but I'm a doctor. I'm an accountant. I don't deal with those things. My business exists whether there's famine or no famine. And so therefore, they'll, in a way, justify it to themselves or even convince themselves of the fact that they won't be impacted by this. So therefore, this isn't the type of threat that's going to scare them. Elam Arova, Amrin Luhu, we say to them, Mefitz v'cherev v'chet shanun ish oneh bireyu eid shaker. The mole and the sword and the sharp arrow, that is when someone testifies to his friend falsely. There's going to be plagues or there's going to be enemy attacks over here that are going to come about from people who testify falsely. So Amar Ravashi, so again Ravashi says about Rova's explanation, Yachad Meimar, Shev Shani have a motna, Vinish below Shnei lo shachim. There were 7 years of dever of plagues, and nobody didn't die at their time. Now people only die when their expiry date comes about. When Hashem wants them, that's when they're gonna come. So you can have these 7 years of this plague, and yeah, people die from the plague, but it's not every day that somebody's dying from the plague. People die in different times. Some people live longer, some people live less. So what they say is, look, the plague comes, but it still only affects people when it's their time to die. So even if you're going to tell me all this plague and problematic pestilence is going to come, doesn't mean that people are going to die prematurely. So that's not scary. You're not really scaring me. El Amar Ravashi. So Ravashi says, this is the threat. Amar Ali, Natan Bar Mar Zutra, Amrina Luhu Sade Shakre Au Grayu Zile. We tell them that the people who are hired to lie, meaning these edim who were paid to come and testify falsely, that even the people who hired you, your handlers, look down upon you. They think negatively of you, dichtiv, because that's what the pasuk says in Melachim Aleph. Voshivu shnayim anashim bnei Belial negdo v'iduhu leimor birachta Elohim v'melech. So there the pasuk is by Navot HaKarmeli, which is, this is Kerem Navot, that Izebel wants to get out of his hands to please her husband, the king, Achav, because her husband wants the Kerem, and Navot refuses to sell it to the king. And so she, with her advisors, sit down and come up with a plan or a scheme to get it away from Nabot. And they do is basically say, go hire these terrible individuals who are willing to testify falsely and implicate Nabot in cursing Hashem and cursing the king. And therefore, he's going to be put to death because he is a Moreid B'Malchut, that's both a Moreid B'Malchut Hashem and Moreid B'Malchut HaMelech. And then the din of someone who's married by Malchut is their property goes to the king. So that's what's going to happen over here. He's going to lose his property to the king if you put up these false witnesses. But the interesting is that when they speak about the people they're going to hire, they call them B'nai Belial, base individuals who even their handlers are going to despise them or speak in a negative manner. So don't think that the people who are paying you think highly of you and they're going to say, oh, great job. The way they speak about you is that they know you guys are these base individuals and we're going to hire them because they're these type of people. Because only those type of people will testify falsely and be paid to do such a thing. But you should know from that if you actually renege on what you're doing here, you actually will upgrade your status because your handlers picked you because of your baseness, because of the fact that you're willing to do this. If you show them in the end that you're not willing to do this, you'll actually gain reputation rather than reinforce what they already thought about you. Imamar hu amar li ad shiomru b'fenenu hudelo shukhaya v'lo matayim zuz. When it says, Misayle Rav Yehuda, this helps. This Mishnah is supportive of Rav Yehuda's statement. Dam Rav Yehuda amarav. Tzarek shimar adayim edai. That when the edim are there and he makes an admission like this, he has to designate these individuals as edim. He does not designate them as edim. They do not become edim. Itmar Nami, we have a similar memory of Moraim, Amrab Chir Ba'av Amrab Yochanan. So here, the girsa that the Riff and the Rosh have, you can see that on the side, is the Tzarek Shiomar Etem Edai. But you have to say that you are designated as my edim. If he does not designate them as edim, they do not qualify. And then we have Tanya Nami Ochi, you have a brighter that's supportive of that, and the brighter brings the language that's in the parentheses over here. It's possible that that was also a memra of Amoraim, the parentheses, or the way that the Riff and the Rosh have it, that they say the same statement as Rabbi Yehuda, Amarav, and then you have the Breita that brings this language, which is, Maneli biyadecha, I have 100 zuz that you borrowed from me. Amalo, hey, he says, you're right, yes I do. The Machar Amarlo Tneuli, he shows up in Beit the next day, and he says to them, pay me the money that you said you owe me. Amalo, Mishatani Becha, I was joking around yesterday when I admitted to it. Patur, he does not have to pay. Lo od, elo afilu yichmin lo edim achorei hageder. Even if he planted or hid edim behind the fence, v'amarlo, maneli biyadecha, says, you owe me 100 zuz. Amarlo, hey, he said, yes, I do. Ritzoncha shit todeh bifnei ploni uploni. Would you admit before so-and-so of this fact? Amarlo, mitjere ani shema techpini. I'm afraid that they're going to take me to court over this. So he admits that he doesn't want Edim to hear because that'll be effective in then implicating him or obligating him. And you have Edim listening to all this and hearing all of this. So Machar Amarlo Tneuli. So again, the claimant comes the next day and says, pay me what you admitted about. Amarlo Mishatani Becha. Says, I was joking around about it. Patur. He is Patur. In all these cases, he does not have to pay. This idea that he's joking around is an acceptable excuse in these instances. And Rashi explains why is because he thinks that the claim is ludicrous. The guy comes in and says, you owe me money. The defendant says, what do you mean? I owe you money. I owe you money. That's right. I owe you money. He thinks that the claim is so ludicrous and so far-fetched. He just wants to shut the guy down and says, yeah, I owe you money. But he didn't mean it. He didn't really mean that he owed him money. He just wanted to end the whole conversation because it was a joke from the start. Now, the Breita continues what seems to be a non sequitur, which is, Ein tonim lemesit. We do not enter a plea on behalf of a mesit, someone who causes someone else to worship avodah zarah. Now, the Gemara asks, mesit man dekar shmei? When did mesit come up in this Breita? This Breita has nothing to do with mesit. The Gemara says, chasurei mechzera, the Breita is missing those transition words. V'achitani, this is what the Breita means. In lo ta'an, ein tonim lo. If he does not make a claim, we do not claim on his behalf. So in monetary matters, where you have a possibility of making a claim and you do not make that claim, we will not enter the claim or the plea on your behalf. So for instance, you went ahead and admitted that you owed money to so-and-so. The next day, you show up in court and the guy says, pay me the money that you admitted to. Now technically, you have a claim to say, Mishatani Becha, I was joking around when I said that yesterday, and I don't really owe you the money. And that would actually exonerate him in that case, allow him to walk out without having to pay. But if he does not make that claim of his own volition, Beit Din won't come in and make that claim on his behalf. That is true, but b'dinei mamononot. Ubedin in a fashot, but if you're dealing with a capital case, then afagav dulotan toinim lo. There, even if the defendant does not make the claim, we claim on his behalf. And that's because there's a requirement, as we saw earlier in the Masechta, for the dayanin to be mamahapech bischut, to look favorably or to find something positive for the defendant in the case. And since they have to look positively, then this would be something that would be in his defense. And therefore they have to bring up that possibility that this is a defense for him. But in capital cases, there is an exception where we do not enter a plea or a claim on behalf of the party or the defendant. That's a case where he's a mesit, where he's someone that causes other individuals to worship Avodah Zarah. Now the mesit is found in the Torah. The Torah is explicit about that. And Gemara is going to bring the pasuk now, which is Maishna mesit. What's the Rebbe Seat? I'm Rabbi Chamar Bar Hukhanina, mi Pirkei de Rabbi Chir Ba'aba, said over from the Shiurim, or the Shir Kuali of Rabbi Chir Ba'aba, Shmi'ali, I heard, Shiny Mesit, that Mesit is different, the Rachman Amar. It's a pasuk that says, Lo Tachmo, Lo Techaselav. You may not have mercy on him, you may not cover up from him. I mean, there's a demand from the Torah to prosecute such an individual and not have any positive bias towards him. We want to rid ourselves of such people. And therefore, we do not look necessarily favorably on his behalf because of the fact that he is a mesit. The pasuk is so obvious and explicit, it's hard to understand what the Gemara is asking of here, ain't toni le mesit in the Braita. The pasuk seems to say that almost explicitly, so then why do you need a Braita to come along and tell you that information? So some suggest, I think that this is a good suggestion based on the Gemara here, the term mesit is, I call it a defined term. When the Gemara generally uses the term mesit, they mean someone who caused others to worship Avodah Zarah. That's the definition in the Torah. On the other hand, you could look at a mesit in a more general terms, and that will come out of the proofs that the Gemara brings in a second, which means it's any individual that causes another party to sin. In that case, he's called a mesit, because he's encouraging someone else to do something wrong. So it's not mesit in a classical sense of mesit that causes someone to do Avodah Zarah, but they see it in a broader sense of someone who causes other people to sin in this case. And therefore, the Yad Ramah suggests that's the explanation of what the Bright is adding on top of the Pasuk. The Pasuk teaches us the principle by someone who does it by Avodah Zarah. The Bright is telling us that that has broader implications to other Averot as well. So I'm Rav Shmuel Bar Nachman, I'm Rav Yonatan. Minayin Shein Toni LeMesit. What's the source for that? Minachash Akadmoni, from the original snake, Damar Simlai, Harbei Ta'anot Ayulo the Nachash, Lit'on. The Nachash had many things to say in his defense when Hashem comes to punish him for causing Chava to eat from the Eitz Hadaat. V'lo Ta'an. And we don't see any of those claims made. U'mipnei lo Ta'an lo Akosh Baruch Hu. So here, why didn't Hashem come to his defense? Hashem's the judge in this case. The Nachash did something wrong, but there are reasons that we could come to his defense. So even if he didn't make those claims, why doesn't Hashem defend him with those claims? The fish lo tan who? Because he didn't make a claim, then we don't make a claim on his behalf. So that's the answer, how we know that a mesit, we don't do it. Now, my havalei the meimar, Mar says, all right, what should he have said? What would have been in his defense? My answer is, divrei harav, divrei hatalmid, divrei mishomim. When you have a clash between the master and the student as to their positions, who do you listen to? Divrei Rav Shomim. You always listen to the master or the Rav. So here, what pointing out is that a Kodesh Baruch said, don't eat it. The Nachash says, do eat it. So Chava, who you should have listened to? Do you listen to God or do you listen to the Nachash? So therefore, the Nachash could have exempted himself from punishment by saying, I can't be held responsible in this case. I didn't do anything that should have caused her to sin because she should have made the decision to ignore what I'm saying. Now truthfully, the Gemara and Kiddushin and the Tosfot over there discuss that this is actually the source for Ein Shliach L'Dvar Aveira. That there's no such thing as a proxy or an emissary to do an Aveira because of exactly this logic. Divrei Arav, Divrei Talmid, Divrei Mishomim. Who are you going to listen to? God or the person who's sending you? The principal who's sending you. If you listen to the principal, then you're listening to the Talmid and not the Rav. And the principal says, you shouldn't have listened to me, you should have listened to God. And so therefore, he has it out here, the Nachash, to say that Chava was responsible for that. Now, the Tosfot says, if that's the case, v'im tomarim kein ko mesit yipater atzmo. That's the case, and you can never bring a mesit to trial, because every mesit can exempt himself with this statement, which is, they should have listened to you, God, not to me. V'yesh lomar, he says that that's only true by Nachash HaKodmoni, shelo nitztavesh lo lesit. Because there he did not yet have a command not to cause others to violate the sin. And therefore he would have been punished if he had made such a claim. But in a case where aval mesich nitzdavesh lo lasit nimsa kemesit over, nowadays where we have the specific instruction that you may not cause others to sin, you may not cause others to go to do avodah zarah, then when he is mesit, he is in violation of the isur. And that's why we do not say divrei rav, divrei talmid, divrei mishomim. Yes, that's an exemption. That exemption will work when you have a specific instruction in the Torah telling you not to do something like this. So not only you're not allowed to sin, but you're not allowed to cause others to sin. And that specific instruction or imperative of the Torah is what obligates you over here. Amar Chizkiya minayin shekol mosif goreya. How do we know that anybody who adds on is detracting? You would always think more is better, but many times adding is detracting. How do we know that? Shenamar? The pasuk says, Amar lukim lo tochlu mimenu. When Chava tells the Nachash, when he enters into discussion with her about the Eitz Hadaat, he says to her, what's the story with this tree? He says, God had told us, lo tochlu mimenu, you may not eat from it, velo tigubo, and you may not touch it. God never said anything of the sort. God never said anything about not touching it. God only instructed that you may not eat from the tree. So here you have an additional restriction that is being mentioned by the woman. Now Chava, it's not clear where she got that information from. Did she make it up? That's what it sounds like from our Gemara, that she added in that additional restriction. Although if you look in the Mishnayot and Avot the Rabbi Natan, it was Adam HaRishon himself that added on the restriction, and he's the one to blame for adding it on. He wanted to put in a rachaka. The rachaka was, not only don't eat from it, don't even touch it. But that caused the problem, because the Medrash tells us that the Nachash pushed Chava's hand to touch the tree, and when she touched the tree, and she didn't die, she said, ah, it's not true. If I can touch it, then I can eat it. And that's what caused her to go on and eat from the tree. So that is kol mosif. He added on a restriction, and that added restriction actually turned out to be a goreya, a detriment or negative, because it actually caused her to sin in the end. And again, whether she added on or Adam added on, you have the same idea coming out of this additional restriction that's being added over here. There are Rishonim like the Rosh who indicate that the problem is that mot tamut. It says the way that Chava expresses it, that you're going to die. And she makes it sound like you're going to die immediately if you engage with the Eitz Hadaat. Whereas Hashem just says that you will die. It doesn't say when. It doesn't say it's going to be immediate. And therefore, when the Nachash pushes the hand of Chava to touch the tree and she doesn't die immediately, she thinks that the punishment may not be real. So either way, it's a mosif. This additional information turns out in the end to be goreya, because it's not true. And therefore it causes Chava to be lured into thinking, or lulled into thinking, that there's not a problem here, and then violating the real isur, which is eating from the Eitz Hadaat. From Mishashi Amami Ocho, you can learn that same din. Rabbi Mishashi says we can learn out of here, Komosif Goreya, Amatayim V'chetzi Arko, 2.5 amot were the length of the Aron. Vashi Amar, it's from here, Ashtei Esrei Yiriot, from the Mishkan, the panels of woven material that were put on top of the Mishkan. There are 11 pieces that are there. So the way that Rashi explains it is that these words with one letter, the whole meaning of the word is changed, which is amatayim v'chetzi arko. The aleph in the beginning makes it amatayim meaning two amot. Had you dropped the aleph in the beginning and read matayim v'chetzi arko, it'd be 200.5 was its length. So the addition of one letter, an aleph, changes it from being 200 to 2. So you see there, kol mosif goreya. And similarly in the next pasuk, the pasuk says, "Ashtei Yisrei Yiriot." Had you dropped the ayin off the word, it would say, "Shtei Yisrei Yiriot," 12. The addition of the ayin drops it down to 11. So again, the addition of a letter causes the number to drop by one. So there you see, kol mosif goreya. So that's the way that Rashi explains it. Others explain, like by the amatayim v'chetzi arko, that the problem is that had you not had the vav achibur there, that's the addition here. It said amatayim chetzi arko. Had it said two amot, or half of its length, that means that the total length would have been 4. Now that you have the vav there, it becomes amatayim v'chetzi arko. 2.5 are its length. So the vav there is the mosif, that is goreya. So that's how some read amatayim v'chetzi arko being distinct from the ashtei esrei, which is the addition of the ayin. But in each of these cases, you see that a mosif is goreya. Amar Abaye lo shano elo da'amar mishateh ani b'cha. That's only if he says, I was joking around. Meaning that when he comes to court the next day, and he says, give me the money you said you owed me, you can say, I was joking around. That's a fine claim. Aval amar lo yudvarim me'olam. If he denies that this ever happened, huksa kafran. then he's considered or classified as a denier, and he actually now is considered to being a lying individual, and we will no longer trust him, because we have evidence of the fact that he admitted to it. So now we know that he admitted to it. There's only one of two possibilities here. Either you do owe it, or your admission, there was something flawed in the admission. If you come along and say, I never admitted to it, then you're a liar, because it's clear that you did admit to it. We have edim to that fact. May not be that these edim are sufficient to obligate you, but we do have edim that you did admit it. And so now if you go and deny that, now you're deeming yourself to be a liar, chuzak kafran, a denier, and we will not believe you anymore. Rav Papa, the son of Rav Achar Ba'acha, says, this is what we say in the name of Rava, komile dichdi lo dichiri inche. Anything that is, dichdi here means like free. Anything that is something that people are not really thinking about or thoughtful about, they do not remember. People will say things or people say anything if they're not paying attention. If they're not held accountable for the statement, people let anything come out of their mouth and they'll say anything. If they forced into a situation where they have to think about it and it's going to be serious, then they'll put their mind to it and remember. So here the guy approaches him in the middle of the street, says, you owe me money. And the guy says, yeah, okay, yeah, I owe you money. He's not really thinking about it. Or even later when he comes to court and he says, I didn't say that. That denial is not necessarily a lie. He just may not remember ever saying it because he wasn't serious when he said it. So here he disagrees with Abaye, who says that he's chuksak kafran. Here Rav Papa says in the name of Rava that he won't even be classified as a chuksak kafran because his denial is from a lack of seriousness or remembering of the issue. He simply forgot about it, and that's why he's denying it now. How the achmin le'edim lechavrei bikilte. Some guy hid edim inside of the curtains or the canopy in his house. Amalei maneh li biyadecha. He says, you owe me 100 zuz. You have 100 zuz of mine. Amalei, hey, the debtor admits to the fact that he owed the money. Amar iri ushechvi lahavi alach sadeh. Those that are awake and those that are sleeping should be witnesses to this. So the guy is trying to lure him into admitting this in front of edim and appointing the edim. So he says, well, the edim that are awake and asleep should be listening. His assumption is that the defendant's going to think they're only sleeping people here, and there are no edim awake to testify. So why would not say yes? But he has these edim hidden that are awake, and then they would become real edim. But it didn't work. The ploy didn't work. Amalei lo. He says, no, I don't want edim on this case. Amarakana. Amar Leilo, Rukana says, he said no. If he said no, then he didn't designate them as edim, and now you don't have evidence where the admission was done in a situation or circumstance where he designated the individuals as edim. How the Achmin edim bekivra lechavre? This individual hid edim, whether it's in a grave or in the graveyard, in order to overhear this conversation. Amar Leil, so he says, again, the claimant says to the defendant, maneh li biyadecha, I have 100 zuz that I lent to you. I'm like, hey, he says, yes, you do have that money. I do owe you that money. Those that are alive and those that are dead should be witnesses. Again, he's trying to lure him into admitting to it and saying, yes, these are my edim by saying, you know, hey, everybody's dead here anyway, so why not let them be our edim? But he also adds in all those that are alive and those that are dead because he has these other edim that are hidden there. I'm like, lo. Again, the ploy doesn't work and the guy says, no. So I'm a Rish Lokish seems to be the Girsa. Hamar Leilo. Again, he says a similar thing. He answered no. If he answered no, he did not designate the Edim to be Edim. Amar Avina, Vite Merapapa, Shmamina Meha. From this you will conclude, Had Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav. That you will come to the conclusion that Amar Rav Yehuda Amar Rav says, Sarich Shumar Atem may die. That you have to say that, or designate these individuals as being the Edim. Loshna Ki Amar Loveh. Loshna Ki Amar Malveh. That can either happen by the debtor himself specifically stating, I want these edim to be my edim, or it could be that the creditor says, these should be the edim to the case, and the love is silent. So over here, silence is acquiescence, and if the love does not speak up when the malve says these should be our edim, then they become edim in the case. And that is concluded from the two cases we just brought before. Taima damar loved lo. Because that's because in those two cases, the loved, the debtor said no. Valishotik, hachanami. Had he been silent, silence is acquiescence, and it would have worked. Because in the two cases we brought before, the failure was that the debtor or the defendant said no. But had he said yes, it would have worked. And the person who was proposing the edim was the malveh, was the creditor in both those cases. He's the one who proposed the edim, and the other party said no. Had he not said no and just been silent, it would have worked, similarly from the Gemara. And that is what we conclude here, that which Rav Yehuda Amar Rav said about atem may die, when it has to be designated, can be said by either party. It can either be said by the debtor himself, where he's appointing him, or the creditor is appointing him, the loveh does not dissent. There was this individual who had an interesting nickname. He was called the Kav Rishu, as Rashi says over here. He was the man that was known to be in debt to many people. There were lots of contracts out on this individual. Malay Kav Shtarot Yeshalav. There's like a Kav full of documents, debt documents on this guy. Amar Man Mesik B, Eloploni Uploni. So he says to the Indian, listen, nobody is a creditor to me except for so-and-so. Ata Tavuladino, Kameder Rav Nachman. So those guys came and took him to bait. And now the claimants came and said, look, he just admitted to the fact that we are the creditors in this case. They brought the case before Rav Nachman. And Rav Nachman, Adam Asuil, Shalo, Lazbia et Atzmo. People will lie in these situations in order to reduce the visible wealth that they have, or in order to mislead people as to how much money they really have. And that's what's going on over here. Rav Nachman says, the only reason the guy's admitting that they're creditors over here is not because he owes the money, but he doesn't want these people to think he's so rich. He wants them to think that their outstanding debts over here, those outstanding debts reduce the wealth that they think he has, because it's not all his, it belongs to the creditors as well. It's interesting, the statement of Rav Nachman over here, because the Havamina, or the way that they called him by his nickname was, there's a full kav worth of shtarot, of debt documents outstanding on this guy. Now, if he really wanted to feign poverty over here, he should have just let the rumor stand. He actually denies the rumor and says, no, I don't owe money to anybody except for these two guys. Over there, you would think that maybe he's telling the truth, because there he's actually reducing the number of debts that are outstanding against him because of the fact that he's now narrowing the scope of who he owes money to. But nevertheless, Rav Nachman says that even in that situation where he admits to being a debtor, that's only to shake off these people who think he is wealthy. And now we have a similar story over here, and then I'll come back and discuss this in a second. They called him the mouse that laying on the money. So Rashi claims over here that Achbar Dishchiva Adinori is someone who is sleeping on a lot of money, which means he has more than enough for what he needs, and he doesn't use it for himself. And that he's a miserly, wealthy individual. He has plenty of money to spend, but he just doesn't spend on himself. So that's what they used to call him. Ki Kashochiv, when he was about to pass away, Amar, Planyo Planya Maskube Zuze, the so-and-so are creditors to me. Butter the Shachiv, after he passed away, Atu Tavinu the Yorshim. So then the creditors went after the inheritors of the estate to get their money. Atu the Kamei Rabbi Shmuel by Rabbi Yossi. So they brought the case before Rabbi Shmuel by Yossi. Amalu, Kiamrina Nadama Swish Lolas Biatatsmo. When do we say a person lies to reduce the wealth that he has, or to make it appear like he has less wealth? Hani Mili Mechayim. That's only true when he's alive. Avalachar Mita. Look, after death, that would not be the case. And that a person will lie during his lifetime in order to mislead people or have people not believe that he has a lot of wealth. But at the point of death, what's the point anymore? He's about to die. What does it matter that he has tremendous wealth? He's gone at this point in time. Therefore, the conclusion of the case was that they would have to pay in this case. Paru palga. They paid 50% of what they owed. Tavinu ledina lidach palga. Atu the kamei derabbi chia. So then the creditors went after the Yoshim for the other 50%. So this time, instead of the case going before Rabbi Shmuel Rabbi Yossi, it ends up in front of Rabbi Chia. Amar lahu, he said to them, Kashem she'adam asui shelo lazbi et atzmo. Just like a person will feign poverty by saying he owes money about himself, kach adam asui shelo lazbi et banav. A person will also set up such claim debts outstanding in order to protect his children from people thinking that they are wealthy. So not only will a person do this to protect himself from people thinking he's wealthy, he will do it on behalf of his children. If that's true, even by death, it might be that when he is saying, I owe the money, it's not because he really owes the money, it's because he doesn't want people to think his children are wealthy. So now, Rabbi Chia takes this standard position against Rabbi Shmuel by Rabbi Yossi. So Amrulei, so the claimants over here say to him, Nezel v'nehader. Let us go give back the 50% that we already got from them. Amar lohu, he said to them, Kvar horez zakein. The elder has already paskened over here, and you do not have to reverse it. So first of all, it's an interesting statement. We just had this back on Daf Chav Dalet Amud Aleph, where Rabbi said this about Rabbi Yossi. Rabbi was discussing the issue of Hatmana by Tzonein, putting cold items into the ground by Hatmana. Rabbi says it's problematic. Rabbi Shmuel, Rabbi Yossi says, my father, Rabbi Yossi, said that it's okay. And Rabbi says about that, Kfar Horez Zakein, the elder has already paskened, and I accept his Psak Halacha. As we saw there, the Gemara discusses the fact that Rabbi is greater than Rabbi Yossi, and despite the fact he accepted his Psak. What's interesting over here is you have the next generation. Rabbi Chia is a Talmid Muvak of Rabbi, and Rabbi Shmuel but Rabbi Yossi is the Talmid of his father, Rabbi Yossi. And now in the next generation, you have the same thing. Rabbi Chia says about Rabbi Shmuel but Rabbi Yossi, if he already paskin, we're going to accept his Psak Halacha. So we're going to leave this, in a sense, in a limbo state. The 50% that's paid is paid. The other 50% that they didn't pay, now my Psak Halacha says they don't have to pay it. Now, what is interesting about this case is the fact that what are these individuals who are the claimants here actually thinking? They went to Beit Din to start with. Sounds like they're honest people, individuals, and they're trying to get the money that is owed to them. So then, over here, when Rabbi Chia paskins that the money does not belong to them, because a person will lie about his children's wealth in order to protect them, then they know that they're not entitled to the money. So why wouldn't they then give back the money? Why are they asking if they should give back the money? It would seem obvious that they should give back the money. In addition, shouldn't they know that the guy doesn't owe them money? Are they really creditors over here? If they aren't creditors, then why are they taking the money in the first place? And if they're not creditors, then they're liars and cheats. And if they're liars and cheats, why are they asking Rabbi Chia whether they should return the other money? If they would lie and cheat to take all the money, why wouldn't they lie and cheat to take a portion of the money? So anyway, the case, for that reason, is a little bit precarious over here. It's not clear why these individuals either are willing to pay it back, or why they don't pay it back, even if Rabbi Shmuel and Rabbi Yossi paskened in their favor previously. So the Orach Lener suggests that they are besafek. They really don't know if the money's owed or not, and that's why they're in this limbo state. They make the claim when they think they have a claim, and then when they think they may not have a claim, they ask to return it, or if they should have to return it. On the other hand, the Rif and the Yad Ramo over here say the individuals who are asking getting the money returned were not the claimants, but rather the defendants. The children who had already paid the money were asking, can they go get their money back, the half that they had paid? And to that, Rabbi Chia responds, Kfar Horez Zakein. So that's one issue with the case. The second thing, which is already raised by the Balei HaTosafot, is that the Gemara over here gave two reasons as to why an individual might lie and say that he owes money. So the Gemara on the first Amud said the reason is because a person can say, I was fooling around, I was joking around. In our Gemara, it says that the reason he can say it is because I lied because I wanted to reduce the number of assets I had or raise the number of liabilities I had so people won't think I'm so wealthy. So why does the Gemara, first of all, give two reasons? Why doesn't it either use Meshateh Anibacha over here and say I was joking around? Or why doesn't it use the answer that we give here, which is Damasui Shalolas Biat, that small person will say things that aren't truthful in order to reduce the appearance of the wealth that he has, or he'll do that for his children as well? Why doesn't that give the Gemara give that reason on the Amud Aleph? What's the difference in the two cases here that the Gemara gives two different reasons? So the Balei HaTosafot say, Adamar beget pashut shchimei ra shul deh, ein tzarech lomar atem edai, mishom den adam mishateh bishat mita. The reason is why by a shchimei ra, the person doesn't have to appoint a deem, is because people don't fool around at death. Since they don't fool around at death, the excuse of mishateh ani b'cha can't be used over here. And Tosfot asks, by my law amrina and kedamar ocha, why don't they raise the issue here, which says that the person's lying, shlo lasbiat banav, v'yishlamar, dehoto mayri kishetov uhu vehodeh. The case there is a case where they made a claim against him, and then he admitted to that claim. The lo shayach taina shlo lasbia ela tanat mishateh. Because over there, the claim of lo lasbia is not relevant. It's only relevant the case of mishateh anibacha. What Tosafot is saying here, or what he's distinguishing between, is the nature or the context of the question that's being asked over here. the toveya, the claimant, comes and makes a claim against him. In that case, if he admits to the claim, he cannot say that shalolas biat banav, that I'm doing that because I want people to think that I have more credit outstanding. Well, that's interesting, because you just admitted to some guy that you owe the money. It's one thing if you voluntarily say that, then we understand that maybe voluntarily when you said that, you were trying to diminish the appearance of assets that you have. So that's why in that case, you can't make that claim. The only claim you can make is, I was fooling around, I was joking around, because I didn't think you really had a claim. So you have to distinguish between a case where there's a toveya, a claimant making a claim against you. At that point, your only claim is, I'm fooling around. But the claim of, I was doing it to reduce the assets, that doesn't hold water there. If he does it voluntarily without a claimant that's there, then we will say that the person will say such a thing. So that's what we have over here. The cases that we brought in our Gemara are cases where the individuals voluntarily suggested that they owed money. They didn't say it to the Toveya. They volunteered the information to a deem that were with them. I owe so-and-so money. And that's the two cases that we brought over here. When they voluntarily say that, then they can argue that the person, they just said it to the edim in order to make people think that they have less assets over here. Tosafot also adds over here that even though we said in the previous amud, ein to'anim, that we do not make claims on behalf of the defendant, that is only with regards to mishateh anibacha, when the individual is doing it as a joke. In that case, we won't intercede on his behalf. Although, the Baal Tosafot suggests that we would make it on behalf of his children, because they don't have the ability to make the claim, or they don't know to make that claim, therefore we will intercede on their behalf. But with regards to the statement of Adam Aswish Lolas Biat Atzmo, Baal Tosafot say there that the court will intercede on his behalf or make the claim on his behalf, as we see that Rav Nachman did. So therefore the Baal Tosafot add on to that distinction between Mishateh Anibacha and Adam Aswish Lolas Biat Atzmo, the additional aspect of whether we are toein on his behalf or not. Others suggest that Rav Nachman wasn't the one who made the claim, it was made by the children, and just Rav Nachman is speaking about their claim, and therefore there's no proof to what the Baal Tosafot are saying. Hode b'fnei shnayim v'kano miyado. A person admits before two edim that he owes money, and then they make a kinyan on this matter. So here you have a situation in which the individual admits to something in front of a deem. It sounds like he designated him as a deem, but he never explicitly tells them to document his admission. But then he made a kinyan to verify that he really owed the money. Kotvim. A deem write it down, despite the lack of direct instructions to do so. And the Rashi and the Baal Tosafot say the same thing, because the stam kinyan, the ktiva made. A stam kinyan is designated or expected to be written down. Vim lav, ain't kotvim. On the other hand, if he does not have a kinyan there, there was simply an admission in front of a deem, but no kinyan made, ain't kotvim. Then you don't document it, you do not write it down, because you do not have permission from the individual to document this item. Because he wants it to remain as an outstanding obligation bal peh, and not bichtav. Bifnei shlosha, if he makes the admission in front of three, velo kano miado, and there was no kinyan there, Rav Amar Kotvim, Rav Asi Amar Ein Kotvim. Rav says we document it, Rav Asi says we do not document it. The reason being is that here we have Shlosha. Shlosha is distinct from Shnayim. Two can act as a din. Shlosha can act as a Beit Din. And that's what Rashi says over here. Asan Beit Din v'hefkiran hefker. In essence, when he does something in front of three, he is, in a sense, creating a Beit Din here, who's empowered to disown people from their property. And they can change it, or they can make it into a loan that is outstanding with documentation. And they can step in to be the representatives of the loveh, as if the loveh has told them that he should go ahead and document it. So here there's this empowerment of these individuals to act like a Beit Din and exercise their rights to confiscate property or to do whatever it is in order to write it down and have it be documented. So Rashi here is explaining the mechanism by which it happens, and the Yad Ramah adds that the admission in Beit Din is the equivalent of it being written down. And therefore the permission to document it over here derives from the fact that the admission in front of a Beit Din is the equivalent of having it a shtar shebichtav. That's the view of Rav, that kotvin. Ravasi, on the other hand, says, ain't kotvin. Hava Uvda, there was a situation like this. V'chashlo Rav l'had Ravasi. Rav worried about Ravasi's position and didn't let them write it down and didn't let them document it. So despite the fact that Rav felt differently, he nevertheless, when it came down to halacha l'maaseh, he worried about it. He was choshesh for the position of Ravasi. Amar Rav Adarbava, ha'udita, we deal with this admission in front of three without a kinyan. Zimyan katvinan, zimyan lo katvinan. Sometimes we document it, and sometimes we do not document it. So that's the machloka we saw between Rav and Ravasi before. Here Rav Adarbava says, sometimes we document it, sometimes we do not document it. Knife viyatve lo katvinan. If the three individuals just by chance happen to come sit down to speak to him at that time, then they do not document it. Confinu iu, if the individual himself asked for these three individuals to be present, katvinan. Then we write it down or we document it. So the reason being is that if the three individuals show up, that is just a coincidence that there are three people there. He wants edim. He wants witnesses. You can have two witnesses, three witnesses, four witnesses. It doesn't matter. It just happens to be that there were three people there at the time. There was no intent associated with the three people being there, and therefore we're not going to treat them any different than the edim. On the other hand, if he specifically states he wants three people to come and sit down over there, that indicates that he's makbid on three and not two. Well, the difference between three and two is the difference between edim, which are two, and dayanim, which are three. So when he specifies he wants them to be the dayanim, that also will make it that it is binding in the sense that he wants it to be written down. Rav Amar, afilu kanfinu iu lo katvinan. Even if he himself gathers these three people in order to admit in front of them, that is not classified as a beit din. Ada amarlu havu alai dayane. Until he specifically states, I want you to be dayanim. Just like by edim, he has to specify he wants them to be edim. So too by dayanim, he needs to specify the same. Mar bar Ravashi, amar afilo amar havu alai dayane. Ravashi says, even if you say that they should be dayanim, lo katvinan. We do not document it. Until they're sitting in court, and they send out a subpoena for him to show up in court, that's the case when it's considered to be in front of the court, and it's binding, and we write it down, irrespective of whether he made a kinyan or he didn't make a kinyan over here. Now, Rashi explains the logic behind this. This logic comes from something that we've said many, many times before, with regards to documents. What's the difference between a milveh peh, an oral loan, and a milveh bishtar, a documented loan? And the answer as to why, when you have a documented loan, a milveh bishtar, you're allowed to go after encumbered property, and a milveh peh you may not, is because a milveh bishtar has a kol. It has a certain amount of publicity surrounding it. And that publicity makes the other parties aware of the fact that there's an outstanding lien on the property. And once we know that there's an outstanding lien on the property, then they'll avoid transacting, or they'll be careful about how they transact over here. But if it's done as an oral loan, again, the debtor's going to try to hide or keep that quiet, and therefore you won't necessarily get that information in the public realm. And people who are buying are going to be hurt over there because they didn't know that there were liens on the property. So that's the difference between a milveh bishtar and milveh peh. Milveh peh does not allow you to go after encumbered property. Milveh bishtar does. What we're saying over here, that Beit Din has a similar effect, which is that when you have the Beit Din sitting in the place where they adjudicate, and they send out a subpoena to bring this guy to the Beit Din, that is a public event. And since it is a public event, that becomes a part of the public realm, and now we no longer worry about individuals purchasing or buying from this party, because they know the information. It's out there now. And that's what Rashi says over here. Naseit kemilveh bishtar. When they invite him to the Beit Din, he admits in front of them, and standing in front of him, he says that. It's the equivalent of a documented loan. Shegluya lakol. It's open and public information to everyone. Hilka chadvina. Therefore, we write it down because it has the same effect as a documented shtar. Baal Tosafot over here bring an interesting discussion as to whether the halacha is like Mar bar Ravashi in this instance, because they have different misorot as to whether the halacha is or is not like Mar bar Ravashi. And that is the halacha always like Mar bar Ravashi? He happens to be one of the batrot. If you think that Ravina and Ravashi are the ones who put together the Gemara, then Mar bar Ravashi is the generation after, in a sense, of the Talmud. So therefore he's considered to be a batrot of the Sofara, and therefore the halacha is always like him. Or there was another misora from the Gonim which was that the halacha is always like Mar Rav Ashi, with the exception of two cases. And one of those two cases is Odita. And therefore, there's a slew of Geonim that do not paskin like Mar Rav Ashi in this case. And Tosfot brings the two sides of the machloket. It's interesting over here as to whether halacha is like Mar Rav Ashi in this instance or not. Hode b'metaltele. If he admits he owes metaltelim, v'kanu miyado, and they made a kinyan about it. Kotvim. There you document it. Again, because the kinyan is nitan l'chtiva. Vim lav. If he did not make a kinyan, ein kotvim. Then we do not document the loan that he admitted to. Because there is an outstanding obligation over here, but that obligation is on the individual, but no lien exists. Because you are mechusar guvaina. You don't have a right of collection from the assets of the individual, just a personal guarantee that he will pay it. And so he doesn't want to document it over here because then that would include an additional lien on assets which didn't exist when it was a milval peh or an admission val peh. B'makarkei, we're dealing with land, the lo kanu miyado, and there's no kinyan over there. My, what's the din? And Rashi explains to us the safek over here, which is that by karka never really leaves the hands of the original owner. Even if one was to steal the land, you can't move the land. The land is still in the possession of the original owner. And therefore, if the person admits to the fact that he owes the karka to this individual, or this karka belongs to that individual, you don't need a kinyan over here because, by definition, it's his property. And as Rashi says, all you have over here is a gilui milta. And the writing of a shtar adds no more lien or right to the asset than existed after his admission that it belonged to this other party. So that's one view. Or the other view is that karka is no different than metaltelin. Without a kinyan over here, the person isn't necessarily serious enough about his statement to have it been documented. That's what we have here, this machloket. What's the din? Amei marmar ein kotvin. We don't write it down. Marzutra mar kotvin. On the other hand, Marzutra says we do document such a transaction. Now the truth is that Amemar's position over here is a little difficult because why wouldn't he allow it to be written down, or why wouldn't he want it written down? He's already admitted that the karka belongs to this other party. The karka is ready and available, but sitting right here for the other party to take. So what does it matter to him that they actually will document it? So the Baal Tosafot bring over here, Beish Lamar, Dono Nechalei, Delifshu Shtara Ilavei. He doesn't want to have many shtarot outstanding against him. The Kalaitbu, because that becomes a part of the public realm or the rumors circulating. Zaylei Nechsei. And then his property or his assets start to depreciate. Kisvurim Sheishtarei Chob. Because people think that these shtarot that are outstanding are shtarei chob, that these are documents of indebtedness. So even though over here, the document is not a document of indebtedness, but admission either of a gift or admission of ownership, nevertheless, it just is a document. And the more documents that are out there, the more people are suspicious that you are a debtor to multiple parties. And that's not the type of impression this person wants to have out there. The Gemara says, Ve'ilchata kotvim. The halacha is that we do document such a transaction in karka, even though there was no kinyan to back up the admission that the karka belonged to so-and-so. The Gemara continues and says, Ravina ikla damharia. Ravina went to a place called damharia. Amarle ravdimi bar ravuna mi damharia the ravina. So he asks of Ravina, Metaltele vi'itnu be'enai umai. Metaltelim were lent out, and they're still extant. What is the din? Amalei kimekarke idamu. They're similar to land. Rashi amar kemi de mechasrei guvaina lo. Since they lack the ability to be collected upon, they are not like land. So you have over here a machloket as to metaltelim that are extant, that were lent out. Those metaltelim, are they considered to be as if collected? And therefore you could document that which is it, like by karka. Or do we view it and say, they're still mechusar guvaina? Since the metaltelim were lent out, they no longer belong to you. Those metaltelim can be paid back as they are, or they can be paid back in monetary compensation or whatever other means the person has to repay you for that which he borrowed. He's not obligated to give you back the same objects that you lent to him. And so therefore, we're not going to allow you to document it.
Because no lien exists. Again, it's only a personal obligation, and the documenting in a shtar but then generate a lien that doesn't really exist over here.
Ha'udita, d'lov k'tivi ba, amar lano, kitvu v'chtmu. V'habule, there was this document of admission that did not have written in it that the party, the borrower, specifically stated that I want you to write it and sign it
and give it to him.
Abaye v'rova, d'amrei tarvayu.
Abaye and Rava both came to the conclusion, Hainu de Reish Lakish. This is similar to Reish Lakish. Dama Reish Lakish, Chazaka ina yidim chutmin alashtar elim kena segadol. We just had this in Baba Batra, that a person will not sign on a document unless the party to the document is over the age of bar mitzvah. So if a person comes along and says, you know, the document is true, but when I signed on the document, I was a katan. I was underage. So the Gemara says over there, we don't necessarily believe it. If their Edim signed on the document, we assume Edim would only sign a document if the parties were Gedolim. And so there we draw a conclusion. That since they're signed on the document, the guy was a Gadol, and it's saying that he's a Katan now, we will dismiss or ignore. So what they're saying is that our case is very similar to this case. The fact that the document was documented, and their Edim signed on the document, even though the document itself, the body of the document doesn't say that there were instructions to document it and sign it, nevertheless, by the mere fact that it was documented and signed by the Edim, is indicative of the fact that it must have been a Hodah that was intended to be written down. So, are there pieces of information that we don't know about? The Sifrei de Beit Dina Yadei? And the Sofrim that work in the Beit Din know better than us or know this information? Rashi says, there are many Dayanim that don't know this halacha. The original statement that was brought here in the Gemara, that Hodeh b'fnei shnayim b'kano miyado kotvim, v'im lav ein kotvim. When there is no kinyan, you're not allowed to document it or you don't document it. They didn't know that information. They're saying, is that something that we don't know? And then Rashi makes it softer and say, we don't know, but other Rabbanim don't know. And nevertheless, the Sofrim, who need to know this information, they know about it? Is that really possible? Shanu the Safrei de Abaye, they asked the Sofrim in the Beit Din of Abaye, V'yodei, and they knew this halacha. Safrei the Rabba, they asked the Sofrim in Rabba's Beit Din, V'yodei, and they knew it. So in Okanami, it was true. The Sofrim were well taught, they were well versed in the halacha, and therefore they knew that if there was no kinyan there, that you didn't have a right to document it. Ha'udita, Davakdav Bey, Duchran Pitkamei, there was this admission document that had the following language in it, which is, this is a Zikaron Divarim. As Rashi notes over here, it's going to become apparent in the Gemara, that the language being used over here is the language that would have been written in a Beit Din, not language that would be used by Edim. V'chol Lishnei de Beit Dina. And a whole document looks like it was written by a Beit Din, saying that we had the admission of so-and-so in front of us. And it doesn't say in the document that this was done in front of three, and one of those individuals passed away. So the situation here is you have a document that uses language of a Beit Din, but there are only two signatories to it. Well, if you were a Beit Din, you should have expected three signatories over here. So what usually you would write is, for instance, in a case where one of the Dayanim passed away or something happened, this was done in front of the Beit Din of three. One of them is no longer with us. Now, it could be euphemism that he passed away and he's no longer with us. Or for other reasons, he's no longer with us and therefore he couldn't sign on the document. That's missing from the language on this document. So that's what we want to know what to do. Language of the Beit Din, only two individuals sign on it. Do we assume that those two are Dayanim and the third guy's missing? Or do we assume those are Edim? And the language, even though it follows the language of Beit Din, was not a document of Beit Din. So, Sava Ravina Lameimer, Hainu de Reish Lakish. So, Ravina wanted to suggest again, this is Reish Lakish. Since it's signed over here, the document, we're going to assume that it was done in front of a Beit Din, even though the language and the number of Edim seem to be inconsistent. So, Amalei Rav Natan Barami, Yochamina Mishmei de Rova, Kol Kiai Gavna, Chashin, a Beit Din Toin. In situations like this, we really worry about a Beit Din Toin, and therefore, we would not accept this as valid evidence. Amar Rav Nachman Yitzchak Ikata Ba Beit Dina Tulo Tzarich. If it mentions in the document it was a Beit Din, then, or in front of a Beit Din, that's enough for the fact that there are two Edim signed on it that we're going to say they're not really Edim, but they are Dayanim, because everybody knows that the minimum number for a Beit Din is three. Amar says, V'dilma Beit Din Chotzavu. Who says that it's a Beit Din of three, which is your standard default Beit Din? Maybe it's a Beit Din Chotzuf. These are insolent Beit Din. Damar Shmuel, Shnayim Shedanu, Dinam Din. Now we saw earlier that Shmuel says that even though you're supposed to have three, if two judges adjudicate the case, they're Chotzufim, but the case goes through. So if that's the situation here, even if you have the word Beit Din in there, that doesn't mean you're going to end up with three, or there should have been three. It might be that they believe that two is sufficient, like Shmuel. Dichtei Bei, no, the document has the following language in it. Beit Dina de Ravana Ashi. It was the Beit Din of our great rabbi, Ravashi. So it says, the Dilma Rabbona de Beit Ravashi, the Shmuel is Firlu. Maybe the Rabbona of Ravashi, of Beit Midrash, they hold like Shmuel. And therefore, they would accept the Beit Din Chatzuv as well. So maybe we're not dealing with three, we're not dealing with the real Beit Din. So Gemara says, no, Dechtibo v'amar lan Ravana Ashi. And Rav Ashi said to us. So here, it's no longer the Beit Din of Ravashi. It is Rav Ashi himself who's doing this. And the assumption is that Rav Ashi would not instruct someone to put together a Beit Din that was less than three. And therefore, even though there are only two signatories to it, we assume that it was a Beit Din of three. Now Rav Ashi makes a point over here. Why does the Gemara here mention Rav Ashi? Why is Rav Ashi relevant? Because his Beit Din was the major Beit Din in Bavel at the time of Ravina. And Ravina and Rav Ashi are the ones who put together the Talmud Bavli. Rav Ashi, Ravina, Sofora. And therefore, it was contemporary, the statements that were being made, and they were entered into the Gemara. So the reason they're mentioned the Beit Din of Rav Ashi is not because there was something unique about Rav Ashi's Beit Din, but because he was the Beit Din at the time. He was the top Beit Din in that time period. And so it would be equally applicable to any Beit Din that specified specifically some big Rav or some big individual. That would have been relevant. Over here, the reason they mention Rav Ashi is because Ravina and Rav Ashi are the ones putting together the Gemara, and so they wanted to identify something in their time period that was contemporary as to who was ahead of a Beit Din, or someone important like the Beit Din of Rav Ashi, the Rabbanan of Beit Rav Ashi, and Rav Ashi himself. And even though, as the Baalei Tosafot point out over here, that we pass an halacha like Shmuel, that a Beit Din of two, even though they are chatzufim, nevertheless, dinam din. So over here, then why is the Gemara saying, oh, maybe they do hold like Shmuel? We do hold like Shmuel, so then why doesn't it work? The answer is, the Baalei Tosafot would say, yes, Ba'alma, in general, we pass like Shmuel, that a Beit Din of two that adjudicates a case, the outcome of that case is binding, even though you should have three instead of two, but it's binding and they're Beit Din Chatzuf. But with regards to Dita, a document of admission, over there, even Shmuel would agree, or we don't pass like Shmuel, that two would be sufficient over there. We would require three signatories or a real Beit Din to sign on it in order for the document to be valid. That's based on what the Gemara said before. If you have an Adita b'fnei shnayim and there was a Kinyan, then you would document it. Without a Kinyan, then you would not document it. So we see that the Kinyan is the pivotal issue and not the shnayim over here. Okay, we're going to stop here, 12 lines down on the top of Lamed Amud Aleph.